the law, on that side of the law. Who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who's against.
Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. This is our first show. Very, very excited, and I want to thank Brian Noonan for sending me off and teaching me basically everything that I know. I kind of look at it as like a spinoff. Like, Brian and I were a pair for 6 years. We were like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and now I'm Rhoda. Or I guess a more appropriate analogy would be Call Saul, right? I'd be like the spinoff of Breaking Bad. So anyway, I'm here with my spinoff, and I'm very excited that people are listening from all over. It's interesting now being on Facebook and all this stuff. I've got people from my hometown in Berwyn listening. I've got people down in Texas listening. I've got my 90-year-old uncle listening in Detroit. I've got new friends from Vietnam and Cambodia who are turning in and tuning in. And I just want to say welcome, and I hope I can entertain and inform. And that's pretty much what I want to do with this show. We're going to kind of keep the same thing that I've been doing with Brian, in that I'll be talking about legal topics from my perspective, not in a boring way, but trying to explain some things that might not be properly explained in the news, in my view, or to give my opinion, or to give my opinion as a lawyer as to how things are done and how things should be done when it comes to various legal topics. And then we're going to be taking legal calls, usually probably around that 8 o'clock hour. We're going to keep that the same. So if you have legal questions, don't call in now, but call in around maybe 8:30. I've got some guests lined up, so we're probably going to be delayed a little bit, and we'll take your calls at 312-981-7200. But this show, I'm going to talk a little bit about a news topic that was in the news this week. But then at 7:15, I have kind of a lighter issue, and here's the issue. This is Donald Trump talking about, I'm going to call it sinkhole countries. I'm not going to use the word that, I'm just not going to use that word. And he said that we should have more people here from Norway. And when he said that, I thought, I wonder what Norway's like. Is Norway a nice place? That's a burning question in the news. And so we have Rob Clabbers coming in from QQs and Trues and Travel, and he's going to be talking about Norway. And then he's going to be talking a little bit about what are the hot places to travel this winter and into spring. At 7:35, we have Dr. Bob and Dr. Judith Wright. They are a couple who wrote a book called The Heart of the Fight. And I love this book because it teaches you that fighting is good in a relationship. And as a lawyer, I see people fighting all the time, and I always think it's bad. But in a marriage, according to this book, it is very important that people fight. You just need to do it the right way. And so we're going to talk to them about that, and we're going to do a little demonstration. Jerry, my husband, and I are going to do a little fight on the air, which will be fun, and they are going to officiate that fight. At 8 o'clock, we're talking to attorney Ross Morielli. And Ross is interesting. He's a practicing lawyer, but he's got a specialty and an interest in marijuana and cannabis. He is a grower, and he also advocates for the legalization of marijuana. And there have been about four or five really hot topics in the news about marijuana and the law, not the least of which is the Jeff Sessions attorney general saying that he wants the feds to prosecute even in those states where marijuana is legal, and we're going to talk about that. And then at 8:35, as I told Brian, we have Jennifer Hayes, who is one of the brave young women who testified this week in Michigan court against the disgraced Dr. Nassar, who had abused hundreds of women during the time he was a physician for the gymnastics team. And she's going to talk from the heart about what her experiences have been and what it was like to testify and be in that courtroom at the time. And then we'll be taking your calls. So should be a good show. I did want to talk just briefly about the issue of the Larry Nassar case. And I want to just talk about pedophiles in general. A lot of people are saying things like, how could the parents not have known? How could this have gone on so long? And there are a lot of questions and not a lot of answers right now. But just so you know, I am a practicing lawyer, and I've been one for 30 years, and I've represented people who are pedophiles, and I've represented victims who have been abused, and I've represented and known, I've known judges who have sentenced these people, and I've been around these issues a long time. And what I do know is this: pedophiles do not come to the job and decide to be what they are. they are what they are to begin with. And they will even craft their education and their job so that they can do what they do. And this is a guy who probably did that. There was probably a time in his life where he knew what he was, and he went to school, and he put himself in the situation where he knew he would have access to these victims so he could perpetrate the crimes. So these are people, too, that know how to charm and manipulate and groom. That word is used a lot. And what this guy did, apparently, was, I'm your friend. I know you're not supposed to eat anything before your meat. I'm going to bring you a candy bar. This is the kind of thing where the children then become trusting of this adult. And the parents become trusting of the adult. And his coaches and the people around him are also charmed and manipulated. Add to it that this is a highly competitive area. All college sports, all Olympic sports are highly competitive. And when you have people who are tried and true coaches and doctors who are getting these girls out and competing and making sure that they're okay and making sure they can compete at their highest level, there is going to be maybe an overlook of what is really happening here. So add to it that some of these people, not Nassar in particular, but there have been over 100 coaches and doctors and people involved in this sport who have allegations have been made against them. So what they do is they move around to different jobs, and there's no way to track why someone is fired from a job. A lot of the gyms don't want to bring it out because then other girls might sue them. They could lose their reputation, not to mention lose all the assets and all the money they've ever made. So there's all of these things that go into the perfect storm of why this kind of thing would happen. What's going to happen to Nassar? Spoiler alert, he's going to jail the rest of his life. He already has a 60-year sentence for pornography, and that was came down in federal court. He pled guilty to that. So he'll serve most of that. He'll probably be 100 by that time. And in this case, it wouldn't surprise me that the judge sentences him to 100 years in prison. So he won't be out of jail, which is good. Civil responsibility, that's the interesting part of this case. Apparently, there have been 9 lawsuits filed against various individuals and various, the gym, the Olympic Committee, MSU, saying that they knew or they should have known what was going on. And the evidence will be put forward, did they know? And the people will come forward to say, yes, I reported it, and the higher-ups did nothing. The coach walked in and something was going on, and he looked the other way. With that kind of evidence, if there is that kind of evidence, there will be a finding of negligence, and I believe that some of these organizations are going to be held responsible civilly for the damages that these girls have sustained, and it's been great. Very, very, very great, as you would see having watched the television that's going on and will go on next week. But in any event, remind you that we will have one of the victims on, Jennifer Hayes, at 8:35. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Government is shut down, but we're here working at WGN. Yes, we are. We're not shut down here. You know what I like about the government being shut down is that maybe the IRS isn't working. I'm kind of hoping that they're not working, you know, because the less that they work, I think the better things are for us, don't you think? And I've got friends at the IRS. They're going to start calling me right now because they're staying up late tonight because they don't have a job tomorrow. But I don't mean that in a bad way. You know how that goes. All right. So a couple of weeks back, we had President Trump telling lawmakers that the U.S. needs more immigrants from places like Norway. And so that got me thinking about, is Norway really that great? I mean, and this is really a pressing issue. And to talk about this pressing issue is the president of Boutique Travel Agency on Michigan Avenue here in Chicago, Q Cruise and Travel, Rob Clabbers. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
So where are you from? Because you have a little bit of an accent, but I want to get that. I'm going to make sure you're not from Norway.
I am not from Norway. I'm actually from the Netherlands. So I am from a country that's pretty close to it and in many ways very similar to Norway, although we tend to have slightly better weather. But I've been here in the U.S. for about, since about 1995.
Okay,
so
and you are my travel agent, at least for the last trip that I took to Cambodia and Vietnam that I talked about on the Brian Noonan Show.
Exactly.
Which was a great trip. Okay, Rob, so tell me about Norway. Is Norway really that great? Tell me some good things about the country, and then I'm going to have you tell me some bad things.
Sounds good to me. All right. So Norway is a country, it's actually quite small in terms of population. There's about 5.3 million people or so that live in Norway. So that's pretty small compared to a country like the United States. It is, however, quite spread out. And if you look at it from a surface perspective, it's about the size of, say, New Mexico. So about 1/30th or so the size of the United States. What is great about Norway is that it's a very beautiful, clean, efficient, high-quality country. As a matter of fact, much so that it that was voted the happiest country in the world.
Wow!
2017.
It's a happy country.
It is a very happy country. There is this.
I wonder where. Do you know where the United States came in on that?
I do indeed. So let me tell you a little bit about
okay.
that report, if you'd like.
Yeah,
it's the World Happiness
that's interesting.
Report. The World Happiness Report is actually from the United Nations, and in 2017.
Don't they have something better to do?
This is just one
just
of many
asking.
Things, right? So what they were looking at is they basically asked people from pretty much all countries around the world, okay, on a scale from 1 to 10, how happy are you? So it's quite subjective. People look at their own lives and then give an idea of how they fare, how they feel about the country they live in. So Norway ranks so well because they look at things like, for example, economic strength, if you look at social support, life expectancy, their perceived corruption, freedom of choice, etc. So it is quite subjective, but they do very, very well, and they tend to do very well pretty much year in, year out. Your question was, where's the United States?
Yeah, where are we?
Number 14, so not
okay.
bad out of 150-some, but still a little bit of room to grow there.
I see. Okay, and I suppose it depends on who's in office and what's going on with the economy. I suppose that's all part of it. So tell me some bad things about Norway. I would imagine, I'm just guessing, that the taxes are really high there.
The taxes are indeed really high, and I was thinking about, okay, so what are some of the things that are not that great about Norway? So I came up with five, and it took a bit
listen,
of doing.
Listen, Mr. Trump. Listen, Mr. President. Okay, here we
go. If you like a drink, Norway's not that great. It's actually very, very expensive. You want to go for a beer that is a couple of dollars over here? In Norway, you'd be paying about $10 or so per,
ooh,
per drink. So
okay.
taxes are pretty high in that regard as well. Number two, it gets dark early. Because it's so far north in the winter, actually, it gets dark, and especially if you go past the Arctic Circle, it's dark for almost several months at a time.
Oh, my goodness.
So if you are a sun bunny or you like to be under the palm trees, it's probably not the right location for you to go to. It's actually kind of funny. There's a small town in Norway that is in a valley, and because of that, it doesn't get an awful lot of sunlight. So what they did is actually put three massive mirrors halfway on the mountaintop, and that now reflects the sunlight into town.
I love that. That's great.
Another one.
Sounds like something I did in high school. Did you ever do that with the iodine and you put the mirrors and you try to get as much sun as you could to ruin your skin for the rest of your life?
Yeah, they'll need a lot more sun over there in that particular location to get ruined skin because of it. But another one is they believe in trolls. And I'm not talking about
trolls.
The internet kind. Yes, not the internet kind. They're actually mythical creatures. And because, of course, Norway is a country with a very long history. It's been that area has been occupied by humans for over 11,000 years. So there's a long, long history. So trolls are a very big part of folklore in Norway.
Who knew?
And if you're a meat eater, you know what? The best food there really is fish. So although that would be great for you, it may not necessarily be that great for some others.
Right.
Finally, another thing that, again, it may not be so great for some people is they're not very big on spending Sundays indoors, hibernating inside, etc. Although they have a heck of a winter, they tend to still go outside. There's a lot of part of their culture is very much embracing the great outdoors. So they really have a concept. They call it friluftsliv, which basically means free air life. And that means that you go back to nature, you interact with nature, etc. So it certainly is not something if you prefer to be inside.
Got it. Interesting. And so let's talk a little bit, Rob. You've traveled and lived in, I believe, at seven continents. Is that correct?
I have indeed been to all seven continents, worked in about three or four of them. So, yes. Absolutely.
Okay. So you not only have just taken a cruise somewhere, you've actually experienced the life in places, which is different than vacationing, because there are plenty
absolutely.
Of places where I very much enjoyed visiting but would never think of living there. You just got back from Antarctica.
I did indeed,
and
yes.
As I said to you before, why did you go there? And what is there?
Well, apart from the being able to tick it off and say that's continent number 7, because I'll be honest with you, that was part of the consideration. It really was more about being able to go to this place that is just so different and distant and that is not occupied. In Antarctica, there are no villages, there are no towns. When you go there, the only people that literally live there, and typically only for a number of seasons or years, are scientists. For the rest, you have a couple of tourists that go there every year, only in the Antarctic summer, which is right now, that's our winter period. And they go to Antarctica to see the vast expanses of space, but of the space there, and also the icebergs, the landscapes. More importantly, penguins. That's a big
They're
attraction.
Adorable, are they not?
They are absolutely adorable. They are a little clumsy, and one of the best things is simply to be able to go there in your group of 10 people, sit somewhere on the side, because that's all the size of the people that can go on land in one go, in one zodiac, if you will. Cruise ships cannot dock somewhere. There is no dock for them to go. It's very much a small-scale operation.
Well, you know, it's interesting, because people travel for different reasons, and I've learned that, because when I went to Vietnam and Cambodia and Thailand and Singapore, people were the same thing. Why would you go there? It has such a tortured history. It's very poor, but again, it's sort of like you can read an easy book and enjoy it, or which means sitting on a beach drinking a margarita, or you can do something very challenging so that when you're done with it, you feel like I've learned something, I'm a better person, I've changed the way I think about myself and my country. And certainly that trip was the latter. Tell me what your favorite trip has been ever, and then I want to talk just briefly about where people should be going in the next 6 months. Where are the hot destinations?
All right.
Got a lot to cover in a few minutes.
Okay. So the one of the places, Antarctica definitely was high on my list, and I would absolutely go back tomorrow because I loved it. I love being able to be out in that atmosphere and have these animals, have these penguins walk up to me. You're not allowed to go to them, but they can certainly, they're not afraid of people. They're not afraid of humans, so they'll come and see you. That was absolutely one of the highlights. My all-time favorite, though, probably would be Botswana in Africa. So a safari. Once again, it's a opportunity for you to see animals in their own life, in their own space. But if you're asking me, okay, what are the hot places right now? The funny thing is, the hot places right now are actually all cool places. So, for example, Norway is absolutely one of them. Whether you go to the fjords in the summer, or whether you go see the polar bears in Svalbard, also in our summer, their summer, it's the same season. Or whether you go in the winter and you go hunt for the Northern Lights, that would be another thing. You can do that very easily. Antarctica is very big as well, and that's a bit closer to home, so that's easy to get.
I'm feeling like people are saying...
Sorry, I meant Alaska.
I feel like people are saying, all right, enough of the cold stuff. Give me a hot destination that's interesting, that I can sit on a beach if I want, I can learn something, I can go shopping, I can eat good food. What would be a good destination for somebody who wants to do that?
South Africa is a great destination for a combination of culture, of beach culture, of fantastic food. I don't even want to talk about wines because they're out of this world, and so is Australia. Australia too has the beach culture, has lots of interesting culture all throughout the country. So these are definitely some great places.
Jerry and I were there last winter, and it's such a diverse place. I mean,
right.
You've got wildlife, you've got the marsupials that we don't have here, like the kangaroos, mm-hmm. and the koala bears. But it's not hard to travel there because they speak English, and it's not hard to navigate. So for people that are out of their comfort zone with a different language, it's not too difficult. It's just a long flight.
It's pretty far, but yes, once you're there, it's pretty easy from that perspective.
Okay. So how about a little closer to home? Give me one destination that's a little closer to home.
I always would say that if people haven't been there, they should go to Alaska. Because it is an absolutely beautiful place. It's nearby. It's the same language, the 49 states. It is absolutely interesting. It is, again, getting access to nature that you do not see in your typical everyday life. And another thing that a lot of people ask, so how cold does it get? Well, actually, it isn't that cold, because the summer season over there, about 70s, 80 degrees if you go in the July summer season.
Thank you, Rob. Rob Clabbers from Q Cruise, which is hard to say, Q Cruise and Travel. Tell people how they can get a hold of you.
Very easy. They can email me directly at Rob, that's R-O-B, at Q, letter Q is in quality, the word cruise, theworldtravel.com. That's the easiest way.
Thank you for joining us, and you'll join us again.
Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Take care. You're listening to WGN. We have fighting music because we are going to talk about fighting. We're going to be talking about The Heart of the Fight, a great book that I just read. And as many of you may know, I practice in the area of domestic relations, which is really a nice way of saying divorce. And I've always been fascinated by people who come in and say, I fight with my husband and I want to get a divorce because we fight all the time. That's all we do. Now, when you read this book, you have a different perspective on whether or not that's the true reason that the couples are breaking up, and we're going to talk about that. And tonight I have the authors of the book, Heart of the Fight, A Couple's Guide to the 15 Common Fights and What They Really Mean and How They Can Bring You Closer. Dr. Judith Wright is an educator with a doctorate degree, lifestyle expert, speaker, and best-selling author, and her husband, Bob Wright, also a doctorate holder, an internationally recognized cutting-edge author, speaker, program developer, and CEO coach. Welcome, both of you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Karen.
All right, so here's, fighting is not bad, right? Fighting is a good thing. Can someone tell me why fighting is a good thing?
You know, fighting is a really good thing. Not fighting is a bad thing, because fighting helps you bring issues up to the surface. It helps you understand what it is you're really feeling. It helps you understand yourself, understand your partner. And actually, if you learn the skills of really engaging deeply in a fight and resolving it, you get closer from fighting. And it's really important.
And I want to address later, the fighting and how you fight is probably very important, because you don't want to be saying things that you're going to regret later. But let's talk a little bit about the myths of romance, the fairy tale myths of romance. And in your book, you talk about how people think compatibility and romance is what makes a marriage or a union work. Is that not true?
It's absolutely not true, as well as the fact that we have so much in common is not true.
Yeah.
Compatibility is just really overrated. You don't really need to have things in common. People think, oh, we have so much common. We love the same music. We love Mexican food. That's not what relationships are about. There are things that do matter. Do you have common values, common principles, common things that really matter to you? That matters. But compatibility waxes and wanes. Studies show it doesn't matter at all.
That's so interesting. And I don't know about dating websites. I've never been on one, but most of my friends have been on one. And I would imagine that the dating websites sometimes focus on those things. Do you like baseball? Do you like these types of things, and you're saying it doesn't matter
at
all.
It doesn't, and it doesn't lead to closeness. It's really not what we should be looking for.
Now, you talk about 15 common fights, and I don't want to go through all of them, but Bob, can you give me a few of the fights that are common that you see so maybe our listeners could say, yeah, we do that one?
Well, let's start out down and dirty, the upper the down toilet seat. It's a profound insult to women when men don't care enough to put that
There's
down.
Also splashes involved.
Yes.
So it's more than that.
That's the wet toilet seat. We didn't write about that one.
Well, it is. It's like those things in any domestic dispute, like who's doing too much of the cleaning or the cooking or whatever.
Very common.
Those domestic disputes are really common.
So what I think you're going to say probably down the line is that the fights aren't really about that necessarily, but then there's a deeper type of issue that is involved.
As a matter of fact, one of the main reasons divorces happen is because people did not fight and did not resolve their control issues up front. And fighting is necessary for us to sort out who does what, who's the best one for what, and to make a good team.
Because it does seem silly to break up a marriage over who's going to wash the dishes and who's going to do these things. But again, I agree with you. I see, and I'm going to say this, like, I'm gender neutral, but I do see a lot of times women will go along and they'll just do their thing because they were taught they were supposed to do all this domestic stuff, and they take on that responsibility. And the poor guy, maybe he would have done it. Maybe he's lazy. Maybe he doesn't want to do it. But maybe he did. He just thought, she's doing it so well, I'm going to step back and let her do it because she knows how to do it. And so at the end of a certain number of years, there's a lot of resentment.
Yeah, there was
resentment. Do you know how many women have birthed two children and talk about the three that they're raising?
You know,
one of our biggest initial fights was around an article Judith read about partnering. And I said, there's no way. I'm not doing half of the laundry. I'm not doing half of the shopping. She says, that's not what I'm talking about. I said, what do you mean? She says, I just want to know that when I'm shopping, you care and I'm doing it for us.
Yeah.
That makes a huge difference.
Get some credit for it. Because some of those things are thankless jobs. You know, even childcare can be very thankless. You're doing the same types of things all the time. It's very routine and your child is not able to say, hey, mom, you're doing a great job, you know, making me dinner. Yeah. You know, the kids take it for granted.
And this is where a lot of the moms have trouble because they have a hard time saying, honey, I really had a hard time today. They usually begin complaining. And the man immediately feels invalidated.
Well, and oftentimes she does make him wrong or say, you don't understand or you never do this without really saying what she does need and what she wants and how she feels. And that's a problem.
One of the things that you talk about is that you use the word yearning and that when you define your arguments, what you're really doing is defining what is it that you want? What is your desire? What are you yearning for from your partner? And why is it manifesting itself in this silly argument? That's kind of how I'm reading
it. Well, I think you read it. Well, you know, like I don't yearn for Bob to pick up his socks. That's not what it is, really, but I do yearn to be respected, to be affirmed, to matter, to be listened to be heard, to be known, to be understood. Those are the deeper yearnings of the human heart. So a lot of times you're fighting for this thing on the surface, but underneath it, there's a much bigger, deeper longing that we have. And when that's met, it makes a huge difference.
And when you explain this in the book, and one of the things that I was really shocked about was that, and I'm going to paraphrase, but you say that when you find a mate, and there's something about finding a mate that kind of pokes at some of the weaknesses and some of the things that happen in your family life going way back, that kind of stokes those arguments so that if I had problems growing up with control, I might be, maybe I'm with a controlling person. So I have something that is actually poking at me rather than smoothing it over.
As a matter of fact,
tell me how that works.
Well, Judith's big word is that your unconscious mind is working overtime to find for you a perfect prick.
What I mean by that is we'll prick your unfinished business.
We can say those words. We have a president who talks like that, so we can talk.
But I mean, it pricks the tenderness. It pricks the wounds that we have. So it's kind of a fun way to talk about it to get our attention. But it really, there's a couple things. One is that you wouldn't even be attracted to someone that didn't represent some of those things of your past. Like, because love is what you experience as a child. So if you had a distant father, for example, distance and love is connected for you. So you'll only be turned on by someone who's probably a little distant. But then that's the thing that's wounding, that hurts. And part of it is that also it feels like we're kind of led to try to pick somebody that'll help us complete that unfinished business. But we don't realize that. We think we've just picked somebody that's just causing us pain. But that's the opportunity for us to really finish our development, really fill in those gaps.
So what do you see as common issues in the past that make people yearn for certain things? You mentioned a distant father, so maybe you're finding somebody who's distant in a long-distance relationship, maybe. And so that sort of emulates what was going on when you were young. What are some other things that you see as being common things that happen in childhood?
Well, first, for starters, you just said it. We define love as our earliest experiences in life. And if dad was distant, then we're going to think a distant man's love matters more than a man who really pays attention to me.
And try to work hard to earn it. And then that sets up resentments and kinds of things as well. We don't consciously know this.
No, but it's a comfort zone in some ways. And I do see that. We all see that in abusive relationships where maybe there was an abusive relationship at home and you think people would run for the hills when they saw that in a relationship.
You got it.
Yeah. But yet they walk right into it. They say unknowingly, and maybe not. It's not conscious, just conscious decision, and so they walk right into that domestic relationship.
It's even worse than that. If you were raised and you were abused, chances are pretty good you're not really going to be comfortable until you have ticked the other person off, and you can feel abused because that's what you equate with love.
That's a little disturbing.
It is.
On that level, it's disturbing. Yeah. When it comes to smaller things, I understand that. One of the things that you talk about is you say active listening is some of the worst relationship advice, and instead you encourage engaging. Is this semantics? We're going to talk about this go ahead.
This is really true. Actually, the studies show that active listening is like the worst marital intervention. It doesn't work. And if it does work, it works for a very short period of time. But active listening is stilted. It's not real. It's like, Bob, I don't like it. I feel upset when you leave your socks on the floor because I think that
I really hate that conversation.
It's really patronizing. It's condescending. It's not real. We're not into it. We're not sharing really fully what's going on. And you feel like somebody's managing you or condescending to you. It doesn't work in real relationships. Real conversations are a lot better. Like, oh, I'm mad. And really, why? And what's going on with me is actually really much more helpful than active listening. It doesn't work. We're taught that so much. We get it as coaching for us. And,
and that's what marital therapists have often been trained in.
Right. Right. To make the conversation nice and stilted and really vanilla. And then you walk away feeling like neither party was heard about anything.
And the positive intent behind that is to teach people personal responsibility. But when we talk about the 7 rules of engagement, we're talking about nobody gets more than 50% of the blame in a situation, and each person is 100% responsible for their own satisfaction.
Oh, I like that. We're going to have to take a break, but we're talking to Dr. Judith and Dr. Bob Wright, authors of The Heart of the Fight, A Couple's Guide to Fights, What They Can Mean to Bring You Closer. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about specifics on how to fight. And then Jerry, my husband and I, are going to fight. We're going to do a real look at he's shaking his head. He doesn't want to do it, but we fought about what we're going to fight about before we got on here, just so you know. And then you're going to tell us how we're fighting, if we're fighting well or if we're not fighting the right way. We'll be back in a minute. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me.
Hurt each other all the time, don't we? But according to our guests, the Wrights, really, we should be hurting each other a little bit. We should be confronting each other and saying things to each other that are really uncomfortable. Right? No, better than not saying.
No, it's way, way better. In fact, the studies show that too, because actually it looks like in the beginning of relationships, if people aren't fighting the first 3 years, looks like they're like really happy. However, after 3 years, those are the couples that are more likely to be divorced because they're not sorting through things. They're not getting to the truth. Fighting is not what causes divorce. That's not the issue. Not resolving them can be, but it's not having enough positives in the relationship to weather those fights and not knowing how to kind of get close together after you've had fights. Those are the issues, not fighting.
So now we know fighting is good. Now we have to learn how to do it.
Yeah.
What are the rules of engagement?
Well,
give me a couple.
The first 2 rules are actually about establishing the conditions of success in fighting. First one being to accentuate the positive. We actually fought over that for 3 years before Judith got it into the book. And the second one is to minimize the negative. And I also had to be convinced of that one over a few years. So those set the conditions for success. And the next one is the really tough one for most people. Nobody gets more than 50% of the blame.
Got it. So the idea is, I really love the fact that you do the dishes, and I really love the fact that you take some responsibility in the home, but the way you wash them I've got to rewash them, and they're dirty. Like that. So I gave him a little bit of the credit, but then I gave my criticism.
Well, that's okay. But more important is that he shows interest in you. That accentuating the positive means, how was your day today, sweetie?
Oh, I see. On a different topic.
It is. It's about being curious about one another.
I see.
It's being available, responsive to one another.
Okay, so you set the stage for something negative that you're going to say.
And looking at you like you matter.
Yeah.
What are some of the things you don't do in an argument? I think you have 4 things.
Yeah, there's 4 that Gottman says in the research, like the real killers of relationship. And one is criticism. It's when you're really criticizing, but you're an idiot. You know, you're stupid. You're really criticizing somebody. You're kind of
judgmental criticism.
Yeah, really judgmental in that way. Another is withdrawing, stonewalling, like refusing to engage. It can become a passive-aggressive thing. It can just drive people crazy. Another is my favorite, defensiveness. I would be in these fights with Bob, and he'd say something, and I'd defend myself. He says, "You're so defensive." And I said, "I am not." And they just proved how defensive I really am. So those are some of the ones. And contempt is probably the worst one.
Mm.
Really just have that hostile, eye-rolling, hostile humor, sarcasm, that dripping kind of venom can really be damaging.
And the lack of respect that it shows is something that can do a relationship in very, very, very quickly. So I think Jerry and I need to do a little fight here. I'm going to turn him on here. Hi. Jerry, are you here?
I am here.
Okay, are you all on board for this?
We'll see.
Okay, let's. Which one do you want to do? You pick. I have one that I have the argument with you, and you have one that argument with me. Why don't you start the argument, Jerry?
Oh, thanks a lot. I'm a very passive aggressive person, and which makes me hold a lot of resentment.
Yeah.
So, a lot of the arguments we have are about decision making, or sharing decision making.
Okay, go ahead.
Unless Karen wants to have a different argument.
Was
that passive aggressive?
No,
that's
pretty good. The closing of the doors, that's the one.
Oh, yeah. One of my big pet peeves in life, because I was raised in a lower middle class family. My father was always like, turn off the lights. It's costing us money.
So you fight know. With me.
Yeah, Karen.
Karen.
What's wrong with you? Turn off the lights.
Jerry.
Close the doors.
Does it really matter? I mean, we're just going to the store. We're going to be back in like an hour. Does it really make sense to get mad at me about that? I mean, why do you harp on me about these things?
Because I just picture you flushing money down the toilet.
But, Jerry, even turning off the light and turning it on again probably wastes more energy. I mean, do we have things to argue about? I mean, you waste things all the time. You leave food on your plate. You do all kinds of things. Sometimes when we go on a vacation, you leave the lights on
oh my gosh,
for the cats.
Perfect. This is perfect because this could go on forever.
Why do you leave it on for the cats and you don't let me just leave my lights on? Can't
so my
you just back
is
down?
My fault.
No, it's not your fault. Just leave me alone. I've got other things that are more important.
Actually,
than
Jerry, you started out with what's wrong great. With you. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah. That's not quite at the contempt level,
but it
implies that she is flawed, and this is proof of that flaw.
Yeah, absolutely. Jerry. I feel flawed when you say that. Okay, so tell me how would you coach a couple to kind of go through this?
Your response was to him that that didn't matter, and so that means Jerry, you don't matter.
Yeah.
So each of you is missing the other's deeper yearning to matter to the other.
And you can keep fighting at this level, but it's not at what's really going on, so it never can really be resolved.
No, it's stupid. It's a stupid fight.
We had a 4-year fight over my slippers being by the door when I get home.
Oh, Judith.
And I thought it was stupid. Why do you want your slippers? I mean, same thing. Why do you want your slippers? But, what's the matter with you? What's all that? I had a very similar kind of thing. Until we really started to communicate and really understood what's it to you. And you said it in the preamble that from your past and your growing up, that was there were a lot of fights in the home. There's tension over money. It was like draining money. You can just see there's a whole other story behind that. So for you, that's much more laden, but it feels just like control for Karen.
Well, and maybe it's because I probably am a bigger spender than Jerry is. That's probably an understatement. I don't really, I don't pinch the pennies like he does, and he would look at a bill and he would go for the sale item and drive an extra mile to get something less expensive, and I wouldn't spend the time doing that. So maybe that's kind of at the fundamental heart of this, is that that's about me being wasteful and he doesn't like me being wasteful?
No, I feel like you don't care about what I think about.
Yeah.
You don't care that this bothers me. It's meaningful to me, but it's apparently not meaningful to you, so I'm not meaningful.
Okay, so that's bad. I'm going to cry, Jerry. No. So how do?
Well, but you just spoke it. You just spoke it at the deep level of your yearning, because you want to know that you matter, that what matters to you, even though it may seem silly to her, is important because it matters to you. Just our fight about Bob's slippers, I didn't get it until I really understood what that meant to him.
So how do we resolve this? How do we talk to each other in a better way other than just talking about the life? How would you get in here?
It actually just started because what Jerry said about how he felt, about what he really yearned for is to matter, and that even though you may not get it, it's important to him and he wants that to be important to you, that matters. But then there's your side of it, because it bothers you that he's treating you that way or trying to control your behavior or saying what's wrong with you. You have feelings about that. There's something that feels dissing to you. So there's something you're yearning for.
But is there a resolution? Do I just say, you know what, I love this man. We have a great relationship. We have so much fun. I'll just turn off the lights. I mean, it's not that big a deal. And if it makes him happy, I guess I'm just, why am I fighting about this? Is that a way to resolve it?
Some fights. Yeah. Some fights it absolutely is that, because it just doesn't matter that much to you, and it's easy to do. When we got married, I was trainable. So what Judith didn't like, I mean, I pleased my mother, I learned.
We all do that, I think, to some extent.
I wasn't as trainable as he was. I was more resistant, more stubborn, so I wasn't that easily amenable. It felt like I was being controlled or dominated, and I didn't consciously understand that, but I fought back.
So when you counsel people in these kinds of things, and I know you do corporate counseling, too, mm-hmm. and these issues arise in corporate settings, like maybe in Congress? I'm just, you know, I was having this flash. I'm a mediator, trained mediator, and a collaborative lawyer, and I spent some time getting training on this stuff. Why can't they get a really good mediator to go into Congress and have everyone sing Kumbaya and come up with the goals that we all have, which is to run our country and open up the doors to our government and just have people mediate? Wouldn't that be a great idea?
When you can find common ground, because really we all care about the same things. We may go about them differently, but we really do care. People in Congress care about government. I mean, it really is that. And in relationships, we do care about things, but we're not always that direct. We don't share our more vulnerable feelings. We don't say what things really mean to us. And when we do, we actually can resolve the fights and get closer.
I want to thank you both for joining me. There is a Wright Foundation. Can you tell me very briefly what it does and how people can contact you?
Can go to rightfoundation.org.
That's W-R.
I-G-H-T, foundation.org, or heartofthefight.com, but rightfoundation.org. We do everything we can to help people live greater lives, with relationships, it'd be career, your own relationship with yourself, living with more meaning. But we have coaching and seminars and skill training and laboratories, learning laboratories. We get supported by other people. We also have a graduate university where you can get a master's or a doctoral degree in accredited graduate university.
Fabulous. The Heart of the Fight, I highly recommend it. Dr. Judith Wright, Dr. Bob Wright, thank you for joining me on my very first inaugural show.
Thank you so much, and all blessings.
Right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
It's the Karen Conti Show. If you just tuned in, I'm usually on with Brian Noonan in this hour, but I now have my own radio show, Karen Conti Show, from 7 to 9 every Sunday, and Brian is from 3 to 7. So his show is expanded and earlier, and mine will start at 7 and end at 9. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for tuning in. We have a little segment here that I'm going to start to every single week, because, you know, it's called Presumed Ignorant, because as I do my research for the show, I always come across criminals who are just plain stupid. And this week, I have two really, really good ones. The first one is a guy named Robert Wooten, who's a 40-year-old career criminal out of Texas. He's alleged to have committed 6 robberies in Houston area. And you know what? He's pretty easy to spot. And you know why? He has his Social Security number tattooed on his forehead. I mean, I don't know. Can you imagine going? I mean, I don't know. And the best part of it is, if you don't know his Social Security number and you want to call him, he does have his area code tattooed on his neck. I didn't make this up. The second presumed ignorant is someone who shouldn't be ignorant. He's a doctor, for God's sake. He's a Dr. Simon Bromhall, who is a British surgeon. He pled guilty late last month to 2 counts of assault. For guess what? Branding his initials on his patients' livers during transplant surgeries. So don't try this at home, but he put his initials SB on at least 2 patients, we don't know how many, during a very lengthy liver transplant surgery. He now is serving time and he has lost his medical license. So presumed ignorant, there you go. I know a lot of people start calling in right now because that's the time that we normally took listeners' calls. But we're going to be a little late today just because we've got some guests and other things going on. So I would say start calling if you have a legal question on any topic. I'm always trying to answer them or refer you in the right direction. Our number is 981-7200, but why don't you wait till about 8:40 and I'll get to your calls as best I can. 981-7200. I'm going to introduce you to a guest who we're going to be talking about marijuana. Earlier this month, our Attorney General Jeffrey Sessions rescinded an Obama directive which told federal prosecutors not, basically, don't go after the marijuana law offenders, basically people who possess or the like. And because under federal law, possession and sale of marijuana is still illegal. And here to discuss this is Ross Morielli. Welcome to the show, Ross.
Thanks, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Ross is in a very unique position because he not only is a practicing lawyer here in Chicago, but he focuses on the cannabis industry. He's the founder of Ataveri, one of the leading growers of medical cannabis, and he's active in both the political and legal aspects of the legalization of cannabis. I call it marijuana, but cannabis is the better word. Is that right?
Yes, it's a more modern way to refer to the plant.
Tell me, what do we have, about 29, 30 states that have medical cannabis legal? Is that about right?
Approximately.
Okay. And how many states have legal recreational marijuana?
I believe it's 5 or 6 currently.
Okay. And Illinois has had medical marijuana for about, 2-3 years, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Give or take.
Now, I'm just curious from a personal standpoint, how did you get interested in this industry? As a lawyer, you're practicing law, you're defending people, you're suing people, you're in court doing all that stuff that we all do, and all of a sudden you're interested in cannabis.
Well, it's I'm also a business person. Prior to practicing law, I was involved in various different companies. And in my legal work, I did a lot of regulatory work. So it kind of, the business interests and the regulatory experience and also my political interests, this seemed like a very good industry to get involved with in the early stages because it involves all three of those dynamics.
So, I used to listen to this, Ross, I'm going to be very honest, and I used to say, it doesn't really affect me. I'm not very interested in legalization of marijuana. But then I had a client come to me who had severe MS, and the only thing that helped her pain, and she had movement, I don't know if you call it spasticity, whatever it was, it was very, very difficult for her to live her life. And when she smoked marijuana, it resolved her problem. And she went and she applied and she could not get it. Now, this was years ago or at least months ago. And I felt terrible for her because she told her, she didn't want to tell her kids she's doing something illegal because she's trying to raise them with good values. But yet this is something that she really needed and she wanted to do it the legitimate, legal way. So I felt for her, and I guess I'm going to ask you, what are the common diseases and the common ailments that cannabis will assist with?
MS is one of them. It happens to be one of the approved conditions. Cancer is another. Tourette's syndrome, fibromyalgia, hepatitis C, Crohn's disease, lupus. There's about 39. PTSD is a newly added condition. 39 or 40 conditions, I believe, that are currently in the program.
And that has to go through a process where there has to be a determination that marijuana actually helps those situations, and doctors have to testify and actually support that. Is that right?
Correct. There were originally 39 in the original legislation, and then in that legislation, there was a process by which citizens could petition the Department of Public Health to add additional conditions. And they were reviewed by a medical cannabis advisory board, which consisted of doctors, nurses, other health professionals, and some patients. And all those individuals were appointed by former Governor Quinn and current Governor Rauner.
And so I just read that recently there was a new condition added, and that was just chronic pain.
Well, are you referring to the court order from earlier this week?
I guess that was what it was. I don't know how it came. But, yes. I mean, that's now approved.
Well, there's a judge at the Daly Center, Judge Mitchell, that issued an order ordering Dr. Shaw, who's the director of the Department of Public Health in Illinois, to add that condition to the program.
Okay, so it was a court-ordered...
Correct. Based on lawsuits for improper denials of those petitions that I described earlier that go in front of the Medical Cannabis Advisory Board,
okay,
then get sent over to Dr. Shaw, and he's rejected them in the past.
So let's take it from a big picture standpoint. Why is this so difficult? I mean, if these people legitimately need marijuana to help with their pain or their symptoms, why do you think there is such a pushback on this type of thing?
It's a good question. If you read through some of the judge's opinions, Director Shaw is, he's violating these petitioners' due process rights. They've all agreed that. The appellate court has even made statements similarly.
But I'm just saying, even just forget the judges and the court system. People say, we don't want marijuana because it's a drug. Even though it helps people. Like, why are we hesitating? My opinion, and it's, I could be completely wrong, is that politicians want to be tough on drugs. And that's a good conservative position because it does make sense. We want to be tough on drugs. Maybe that's a good thing. And so if they say, let's legalize marijuana for medical, they're going to look like they're soft on crime.
I mean, some people might think that. I think that most of the, I don't want to say this, but from my interactions with many members of the General Assembly here, most of them seem to understand that medical cannabis helps people. Recreational use or adult use, not being in a medical program, is a different topic. But in the medical side, it's important because it helps people. A lot of people are if you don't have an approved condition in Illinois, you're forced to take prescription drugs, a lot of times opioids, and that causes problems. It can kill you. It leads to heroin addictions. It causes people to be constipated, where you need another pharmaceutical drug to help with your opiate-induced constipation. Whereas people have the option for medical cannabis, you don't get those side effects, and you often get similar, if not better, relief. And it won't kill you. So I think that's why it's important. And I think, you know, there's polls out there that have been conducted, and, you know, 88%, I believe, of Illinois likely voters think that a decision should be between a doctor and a patient. And if the doctor and the patient think that if medical cannabis will help in lieu of prescription opioids, then that patient should be able to be in the program and be eligible to do that.
That, to me, seems like a no-brainer. We're here talking to Ross Morreale, who is talking about medical cannabis and recreational use of cannabis and the law. This is Karen Conti's show on WGN. It's the Karen Conti Show on WGN. I'm talking to Ross Morreale, who is the president of Ativeris, which is one of the leading growers of medical marijuana in Illinois. Ross is also a practicing lawyer. And, Ross, would you like to take a call? I've got someone who's got a question.
Sure.
All right, here we go. We got Charlotte. Welcome to WGN.
Hi. I was reading some IFI literature a while ago, and I read that the Federal Drug Administration has not yet approved as safe or effective any of these so-called diseases. So why hasn't the FDA approved all these 30 medical uses?
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold there, Charlotte. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
I can't speak exactly why the FDA does or doesn't do what it does, but I don't think it would be their call. I think it's still federally illegal, and Congress would have to act, I think, before the FDA would get involved in making such a determination.
Well, let's get real clear here, because I think people are a little confused. We have a very odd situation here. We have the federal law that says that marijuana is still a drug that can be prosecuted. That's the federal government. The states have done different things. And like you said before, about 30 states have authorized it for use in medical situations and some in recreational. So who wins that argument? What if you do all the right things in the state? Can the federal government come in and stop you and arrest you because it's against the law from a federal standpoint?
Well, that's a very timely question. If you are not prior... The way it's been since 2014, there's been an amendment federally in place called the Rohrabacher-Blumenthal Amendment, and that basically cut off all funding to the Department of Justice to prosecute or investigate any state-licensed cannabis company that was following the state laws.
So there was no funding to do it, so therefore they couldn't enforce it.
Correct.
Okay, that's one way to do it.
And this is going on in this current budget battle right now, where now that the budget has lapsed, there's this gap period where technically, from what I've read, there is no protection anymore for us. But once it is passed, hopefully in the next week or so, and we're out of the government shutdown, that this gap would be covered by the future passage of it.
Well, you know, it just seems to me, just from a real basic standpoint, that this really creates a disrespect for the law in some ways, because if our government... Our federal government says it's a crime to do this, but our states say, no, not only is it not a crime, but we're going to license it, we're going to regulate it, we're going to approve of it, and to even have the possibility that the federal government could do otherwise than let them have their career. I mean, I'm sure you spend a lot of money going through this process and the growing situation. You probably invest a lot of money in it, and it causes a serious problem in the law, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a states' rights issue, and right now it's very murky on what the federal government will or won't do. I think most of us are optimistic that if you're in a very regulated state like Illinois is, that you should be fine. If you're in a state like maybe California, where it's very unregulated or less regulated, or Colorado or states like that, I think those would be more of federal targets if, you know, Attorney General Jeff Sessions wants to do something.
Give me your best argument as to why cannabis should be made legal in all states for recreational use as well as medical use.
Alcohol is, and cigarettes are. They have no medicinal benefits at all. In fact, you know, alcohol leads to cirrhosis of the liver and kills people and causes for is a source of liver transplants. Tobacco kills people. There's been lawsuits.
Of course.
There's no upside or benefit to tobacco. So I would say if those two you can go buy if you're 21 or 18, that why shouldn't you be able to buy a cannabis product that's tested and regulated market that could actually help you and isn't going to kill you?
And this argument that once you start with marijuana, that will lead you to worse drugs. That's always been the argument that I would hear. And what do you have to say about that?
I think that the gateway argument's a fallacy. I think that prior to anybody smoking marijuana or doing any other drug, they probably drank something and they probably smoked a cigarette. One of those two things are probably the gateway. Or pharmaceutical drugs. I mean, let's look at what's going on here with the opiate crisis in our country. I mean, that's a gateway to heroin. I mean, once your doctor cuts you off because you've prescribed too many and he gets a little uncomfortable about his liability, a lot of patients go to the street and they use heroin. And that's why, you know, law enforcement in the state have certain medicine in the vehicle, I forgot what they're called, but they have shots they can give you to help with a heroin overdose.
Now, you know, I'm sure there's no really good survey to say, hey, if you didn't have your OxyContin, would you take up smoking marijuana? Is there some proof, is there some study done that says that people would do marijuana to get whatever high they want rather than do the serious drugs like the opioids?
I'm not sure.
Okay, because it just seems to me that, you know, if someone is after a high, and I certainly can't compare the highs myself, but it seems to me that that's an option. That's a much less serious option and one that's not as addictive.
For sure. And in a lot of instances, cannabis helps people get off of opioids. It's part of some therapies that they have, or methadone clinics as well. Cannabis is sometimes incorporated to help people wean off of those dangerous, deadly, you know, pharmaceutical drugs.
Well, we're going to have some really interesting changes in the law, I would say, in the next year or two. I'm talking to Ross Morielli. Thank you for joining us. And can you tell everyone how to reach you if they have an issue or question?
You can send me an email at Ross, or not at Ross, but Ross at RossMorielli.com.
MORREALE. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. On WGN. We're going to be taking your calls on any legal topic in about 15 minutes. Call us at 981-7200, 981-7200, or you can text us at that same number. If for some reason you don't get through, you can always call me at my office at 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. Well, this week, former physician Larry Nassar pled guilty. He had pled guilty, and he's being sentenced. And in the process, there are 120 women who are expected to testify as to sexual abuse that he perpetrated on them while he worked at Michigan State. I watched some of the television video of it, and it was really heart-wrenching and disturbing at the same time. I want to play just a few clips of what happened this week.
You have no idea what this man is capable of doing and of how he used the weaknesses of this culture to satisfy his own demented needs.
What I've come to realize is that some of these girls were smart enough to catch on to this disgusting game, and nobody did anything about it. Nobody protected them. So while I beat myself up with these if-only thoughts, I now realize they would have probably never even made a difference. But I still can't help but wonder, maybe somebody would have listened to me.
Very, very, very disturbing. And tonight we have with us a very brave and strong woman, Jennifer Hayes, who was one of the victims who testified this week. Welcome to the show, Jennifer. Thank you so much for spending the time tonight to talk to us.
Thank you. Good evening.
So you were a figure skater, is that right? And you were treated by Dr. Nassar, is that right?
Correct.
And how is it that you came to, were you at MSU at the time?
Yes, I was a student at Michigan State, and at the time I was also the head coach of the MSU synchronized skating team, and I had some injuries that were still lingering from my competitive years, yes.
Let me ask you this. When you first heard that Nassar was going to be prosecuted, what was your first thought?
Well, for me, I'm 38 years old now, and so he abused me back when I was a college student. So I found out last January when I discovered news online that he had dozens of cases filed against him and that he was in FBI custody for child pornography. But before I had even read those details, I already knew right away what his charges were. And immediately then I was hysterical, had full body trembles, and immediately left work and went to my car and just screamed.
Jennifer, did you have any idea that he had abused other women?
No, I had no idea. I mean, at the time, I was trying to convince myself that this was normal, legitimate medical treatment. He's very, very manipulative, very smooth, convincing. Every exam room of his is filled with signed Olympic framed pictures of him and other Olympic gymnasts at the Olympics. You know, one of the famous ones was when he was walking Carrie Strug off after the vault, you know, winning the Olympics.
Yes.
So he had stacks and stacks of photo albums of all these pictures in addition to. So it's pretty intimidating. And why would I ever question him and his treatment when every time I went to visit him, you know, no matter what room I was in, there was always, you know, hundreds of those pictures around. So
and when you knew this happened and you were upset about it and it brought up all of these bad memories, at some point that you were called to ask if you would like to participate in the trial to be read a victim impact statement. How did that work, and who called you, and what did you feel about that when you got that call?
Sure. So immediately that night when I received, you know, this notification, I called the FBI right away. That wasn't the most appropriate person to call, and I got in contact with the detective, the police working the case. And so just a few days later, I went and gave my own statement. And at that time, Detective Andrea Munford gave me my options as to, you know, how much involvement I wanted to be in this case. And I knew immediately that I wanted to not only just help myself, but help any other little girls and women out there that have not yet found their voice or strength to come forward.
Was there ever a thought that you didn't want to participate, and that in doing so you would just dredge up more bad feelings, and that you just wanted to walk away from this? What made your decision to go back and testify as you did?
You know what? I never hesitated. I knew for myself that that's what I needed to do. I felt like I was living a secret and a lie for all these years, and now it kind of was all making sense, and the pieces were, you know, fitting together. Not necessarily that night when I found out, but you know, the weeks later, I knew this. I knew I had to stand up for what is right.
And has your involvement in this, do you think, has this been good for you in the long run? I mean, horrible and hard and heart-wrenching and difficult and emotional, but in the long run, do you think this is in some way cathartic and in something that you needed to do?
For sure. I mean, the past 3 months have been the most emotionally challenging of my life. I've been re-traumatized all over again. And, but it's been great to actually speak, look evil right in the eye and basically say everything that I've been wanting to say all this time. And, a whole, you know, big weight has been lifted off my shoulders. More of my family and friends are now aware of what I've been going through, so I've gained a lot of support. And then I've gained a whole new family. All the survivors, yes. Judge Aquilina has called us the Survivor Sisters. And it's been great. We've exchanged phone numbers and contact information over the last few months. And we've helped each other get through some of our darkest emotional days in these last few months. And then just all being together this last week, you know, we talk, you know, before court starts, after court starts, during lunch, during mid-morning, afternoon breaks. And, you know, we go out to dinner in the evening and we've really, you know, we're from all over the country, all over the world. And
you're all athletes.
A lifelong right. family.
That's amazing. Yeah. I'm just going to read briefly a portion of your statement. I have invisible sure. wounds that have forever changed my life. I am changing that today. You stole my confidence and self-worth, but I am regaining it. You will not break my core, and you no longer have power over me. As a mother of one, soon to be two daughters, I have now had to redefine what it means to keep them safe. You will never hurt me or another girl again. I will find peace. The other survivors, my family and friends, are helping me with that. I cannot forgive you today. You are in God's hands now. Very, mm-hmm. very, very powerful words. As I sit here, and my hands are shaking. I saw that Dr. Nassar cried.
Mine too.
Yeah, yeah. So you're very, very brave. It was a brave thing to do. He cried in court this week. What did you make of that?
Oh, if we can call it that. So I've been there every minute that court has been in session. And I will continue to until it's over. And he really, he's had the most confused look on his face the whole time. He's looked us right in the eye, but he scrunches his forehead and just looks confused the whole time. And I think I've only seen him have tears a couple of times, and that's really only been when survivors have been close to him and his family since, you know, for decades, and they've brought up, she has brought up something personal, like one time it was in regards to his brother's funeral, hugging her at the funeral or something, and that was just a lie, and that's when he took off his glasses and started wiping his tears. But when his own children have been brought up, he hasn't even looked concerned or cried.
I take it that, you know, he's crying for himself, because I stated earlier in the show, pedophiles really don't understand. They really don't know. They know what they're doing is wrong, that it's society has made this illegal. But in their minds, they've justified that this is something that is okay, and that was something that was good and beneficial, as sick as that may be. Jennifer, one of the last things I wanted to ask you is you're a mother, which is wonderful. I know mothers are sitting out there saying, how do I trust people? This is a world class doctor. What pointers or what advice can you give to mothers of young children on to try to avoid this kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say the grooming process is real. A sexual predator will try to gain a child's trust by really paying them special attention, appearing sympathetic, even, you know, turning loved ones against them, giving gifts, obviously finding ways to be alone together. I recommend parents talk to their children at an early age. Like you said, I have a young daughter. I have another one on the way. and you know, I've already started talking to her. I was just talking to her about her anatomy, private areas, appropriate touch, and always, you know, as they get a little older, my daughter's very young, but as they get a little older, and you know, letting them know that they can always come to their parent with concerns and someone that they can trust.
Keeping the door open.
A lot of times sexual predators are someone we know already and that we trust, like teachers or coaches, family members, doctors, just, I mean, that's just to name a few. And I would just say be active in your child's life. Ask questions, even when it may be uncomfortable to do so, because it may save your child's life.
Jennifer, I want to thank you for your bravery. I want to thank you for participating in the trial, because for everybody, I'm telling you, you know, I know you spent some time in Chicago, you're back in Michigan now, but you know, everyone's rooting for all you guys, and it's the talk of all women and men everywhere. It's just been a very eye-opening experience, and I know it's not easy for you to even come on the show and talk, and I want to thank you for sharing your experience and wish you the very best.
Thank you very much for having me.
Your lawyer called and said he had the papers all prepared. To sign my name was all I had to do. He saw the judge, now he's seen.
Welcome back. It's Karen Conti with the Karen Conti Show. Again, if you just tuned in, I'm usually on with Brian Noonan from 8 to 9, but now I have my own show from 7 to 9. Brian's been moved up to 3. He goes from 3 to 7. I go from 7 to 9. And then Rick Hogan is next. That's the lineup. Well, this is my first show, and it was fun, and I hope to continue to do this again and again. If you have any questions, if you have any legal questions now, I'm ready to take them. I know it's late in the game, but if you have any questions, I'll try to get you right on. 981-7200, 981-7200. If you don't get in right now to call me, you can always email me at wgn@askkarenconti.com. I just want to talk a little bit about the Women's March. I want to congratulate everyone who had a good time and went out there in March. There were somewhat like 300,000 people out there, all kinds of young people, old people, men and women. It was really great to see. And the one comment that I heard over and over again from people around me was, what was the message? I didn't see a cohesive message in the march. And I guess maybe I understand that comment, but it seems to me that the upshot of what I got from it was that women are to be reckoned with, and women are a voting bloc, and women have rights that have been trampled on, let's just say that, and they want to be heard. And whether that is about sexual harassment, whether that is about issues that are about reproductive rights, whatever it is, they want the administration and they want the local lawmakers and everyone to hear them. And I have to say, I was born into a time where, you know, we had rights, women had rights, of course, but we sort of take them for granted in some ways. And we also take for granted, I think, maybe not now, but we sort of took for granted that sexual harassment was part of the bargain. When I first started practicing law, I was subjected to sexual harassment on a regular basis. And it was something that I thought just came with the territory. I'm a woman. I'm working. There are men there. It's going to happen. And now I think it's just refreshing to see that people are saying, no, it doesn't have to happen. And we're going to talk about it, and we're going to do something, and we're going to march about it. And I love the voice, and even our Jennifer Hayes, our wonderful, brave woman who testified in the Nassar trial up at MSU, she's being heard, and I just think being heard and making people aware, always, always, always a good thing. I'm still waiting for the callers, but I wanted to tell you, I had a couple of emails this past week that I thought were very interesting. I had an email from a person out in the western suburbs. I have heard that the new child support laws in Illinois favor men. Is this true? And what does this mean for the mothers who are divorced and the whose exes are paying support? That's an interesting question, and I emailed back. But I want to just talk just briefly before we leave about the divorce laws and how they've changed. There's a new child support statute. It used to be that the payor, the person who didn't have full-time parenting time with the child, would pay a certain amount, a certain percentage, 20% for one child, 28% for two, etc. So that was just a formula, and it wasn't always fair because it didn't take into account the parent with whom the child was living. So to try to rectify that inequity, the lawmakers got together. In fact, I was on a committee that made some recommendations on these types of issues. And the legislature decided that there is what we call income shares, which means that you take dad's income, you take mom's income, and you see what the child actually needs to live, and then you do a pro rata ratio, in essence, of what that support should be paid from one party to another. So the law is gender neutral, as all the laws in family law are, but if you're a mom and you have parenting time, you know, residential, we don't call it custody anymore, but if the child resides primarily with you and dad is making those payments, generally speaking, in my experience so far, the father is paying a lot less to the mother. And that's just as a result of the way the calculations are done. So that is a problem, and I think it's probably going to be rectified. I think, it's extremely low, and I think fathers are relieved in some way, but the real key question is, does this really help the child? And is this helping the father and not helping the mother? That remains to be seen. But there are some changes that you should be aware of, and it's going to affect a lot of people down the road. Let's take one last caller. It looks like we have Sean. Sean, hi. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you?
Hello, Karen. Hi. Congratulations. You're the second woman I think WGN's ever given a show to after Patty Vasquez.
Oh, is that true? Well, here we are. I'm marching here.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Sean. Give me your question so I can answer it before the buzzer here.
Probably. Well, the real quick one was not just medical, but legal malpractice. Is there a statute of limitations like everything else?
Yes. It's generally 2 years from the date of the wrongdoing or from when you learned about it. And there's some exceptions to that, but that's the general rule. It's the same as a car accident, so it's negligence against an attorney 2 years from the date of the wrongdoing. Thank you for the call, Sean. I want to thank all my guests, Ross Morielli, thank the doctors Wright, and I want to thank Jennifer Hayes and Rob Clabbers from Q Cruise and Travel. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. This is Karen Conti on WGN.